You are listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 2309 North Broad Street. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 and 7 p.m.
I want us to talk about suffering and how we're intentionally approaching it during our suffering. Because in Lent, you're trying to intentionally experience some suffering and create a space where you can feel it. But if you're being particularly in tune with your pain, you'll be weary. So I hope we can find rest in Jesus despite our weariness. I want to talk about that today. I'm going to keep this whole season is about finding rest for our souls and not being afraid of our suffering. We need to face our suffering to know how to overcome it. We're thinking about this little passage in John 9. I'm going to keep showing you this Van Gogh painting too throughout the season. We can't avoid our suffering because it won't go anywhere. The age-old question, Job asks it in the oldest book of the Bible, and Jesus has asked himself right here, why is this man blind? Why do we suffer maladies? As Jesus walked along, he saw a man who was blind from birth. Jesus' disciples asked, Rabbi, who sinned? So that he was born blind. This man or his parents? Jesus answered, neither he nor his parents. This happened so that God's mighty works might be displayed in him. While it's daytime, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. When I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. Jesus is getting ready to die. We're about the middle of John, and the second half of John is all about Jesus' death. It's just like many biographies written at the time. There's an extended death sequence. Jesus is considering his own death. Why am I going to die? So that God's works might be displayed in me. And in this specific instance, that's the case. The disciples don't ask Jesus why this man is suffering. They assume they know he's suffering because there was some sin involved. Either he did something or his parents did. Very Jewish argument, in fact. Jesus makes the argument, no, not to create a causal relationship. He's talking specifically about this man who will demonstrate God's mighty works in not just being healed by Jesus, but by who he names Jesus to be upon being healed. He names Jesus as Lord. That is the mighty work that is being displayed. In the book of John, Jesus does a lot of interesting things, signs. He calms a storm. He heals people. He walks on water. He feeds 5,000. He turns water into wine. Lots of different things in John, like seven signs. He raises somebody from the dead. I think I named like five right there. There's a couple of healings, so I think it makes up seven. No, that's about right, seven. Although you could, at the end of his life, he also catches all these fish in John. That's like the eighth sign. This is too much details. But all of those things that he does are not to like throw a killer party at the wedding of Cana. No, they're to show the world who he is. They point to Jesus. They aren't the end. So even healing this man isn't the point. And in fact, in John, Jesus says, it is better if you believe without seeing. So in my opinion, Jesus isn't even naming blindness as something that you must overcome. In fact, if you believe without seeing, your faith is better. But we get back to this question. We all have it. Why do we suffer? In this case, one good thing can at least come from it. I think we find it comfortable to answer these big questions because that's what we've been asking for ages, and a certain answer would bring us some comfort. But I'm afraid with God, such certainty is unlikely, and such arrogance to think that we could find such certainty is problematic in that if we ever think that our certain image of God or formula for God is challenged, it may not be able to withstand a change. If you're too certain, your faith is made of material that's too rigid, that may break before it bends. And I think God is calling us to enter the world with open hands, to move with faith, not necessarily certainty or rationality. And I struggle to answer the question when I think of suffering in the world. I don't often ask God why he causes the suffering to happen. That's not really how I relate to God. However, I don't have a great answer, to be frank with you. And I don't think I'll be satisfied with a great answer either, and I'm okay with that limit. Our limited ability to explain these questions, though, gives us a little window into suffering. We can't answer the question of pain, the problem of pain, with certainty because we're limited. We experience suffering also as another expression of our limit. The world is not complete. The world needs to be completed by the work of Jesus, happening now among us and happening in the future. I don't want to leave you hanging, though, so I want to offer you this little theory that might stir your interest. There, Beth, stir your interest. I was thinking about a good word, because I didn't like the one I used in the earlier one, so I polled people and found one. Now you're wondering what that word was. I'll tell you later. I'm going to give you a little theory from a theologian named Deborah Creamer. Here she is. It's about our limitedness. She offers in this book a theology of disability. There's a theology of everything, okay, it seems like. And this is one of them. You know, eventually you have all these, you know, postgraduate students that need to come up with something to write about. So this is it. I'm not trying to minimize her work, though, because I think it's quite moving. She questions our assumptions about what it means to be normal and disabled. She highlights impairment as an unsurprising reality and aspect of the human condition, something that we will all experience in our lives. We progress toward impairment. We take risks. We age. Like, parts of my body hurt now for no real reason. You know, you just wake up, something hurts. Like, my arm hurts. I have no idea why my arm hurts right now. I don't know what happened, and I'm in a little pain right now. Don't know why. I just live, some impairment with your age. And we're surrounded by our limits, which we do not consistently describe as impairment. We can't fly. We experience scarcity in natural resources. Contrary to many people's beliefs, we all tire and die. Human life is an experience of limits. We have a limited life. That life is completed eventually by God. But we have a lack. And that's okay. This idea observes that our notion of normal is an illusion. And it could be a dangerous one. You might think you're limitless. And in your 20s, you often do. That's why you see all these 20-year-olds without their helmet riding a bike. You see anyone do this, by the way? You do it?
No, I see people do
it. Okay, wear your helmet. It doesn't matter. You look great. You know, no, because some people think, I'm not going to wear my helmet because I don't look good. This is an actual mentality, which is very surprising to me. Never mind, I'm not going to go on a helmet diatribe. I already did, you know, so it's over. But I really believe that if you choose to ride a bicycle, you should wear a helmet. Because you're limited, and something bad could happen. Our idea of normal is an illusion and a dangerous one at that. That's where the helmet happened. Instead of cementing disability as a distinct and separate category, let's think about limits as normal, unsurprising, fluid, maybe even good. I'm not saying, and she isn't saying, that we're all disabled. That's not really fair. However, under this idea, it becomes a little bit absurd to list someone who is blind from birth, someone who's in a wheelchair from a skiing accident, and somebody who is diagnosed with Down syndrome, all in the same category as disabled. It's also, we can begin to ask, why do we see a wheelchair as a sign of disability as opposed to a piece of technology that helps somebody's life, not unlike a car or a calculator or eyeglasses? What if that life even highlighted positive things, positive characteristics of disability, such as creativity, interdependence, perseverance, rather than defining disability as an experience that we would all like to avoid as much as possible? When we frame our suffering, no matter how bad it is, as a consequence of our limitedness in the world, and we begin to be creative about what we do with it, it becomes more of an opportunity as we approach coming completion. Our own suffering and our antagonism towards it is neutralized a little bit when we understand that life is full of experiences, both bad and good, that we may experience differently. We're all limited. And maybe that's part of why we suffer. Lent is this fast about learning how to suffer in order to see more clearly. The way we try to cope with our suffering is part of what makes us blind to it, to what's really there. Lent is about removing a little bit of your coping mechanism, even benign ones, neutral ones, or healthy ones, in order to see what they cover up. How does one cope with suffering? How do we deal with our pain? I think one of the main ways we do it is by covering it up with pleasurable feelings. We try to get a little pleasure. So some of you know, I enjoy cooking. And I enjoy reading about cooking. Sometimes I think I like reading about cooking more than I like cooking. Although it's a close. I like reading through cookbooks. I will read cover to cover a cookbook. And that's like the day's reading, you know? And I feel bad. This is my mentality works. I feel guilty when I don't do that. When like I have unopened cookbooks, I must read them and use them. That's how I feel. Anyway, I want to teach you something about what to do when food is too spicy. And I know some of you people are like, hey, no food is too spicy for me. I really like spicy. Okay, yes, I know. You can handle it. I get it. You always go for the suicide wings and you act like it doesn't hurt. You know, it does. What do you do when you're eating a habanero or something? First of all, did you know that spicy food gives you a little buzz? And that's not because you're chasing it with beer or something like that. It's because it sets off pain receptors in your brain, which then provides you with endorphins. And so your body thinks you're hurting it, which you kind of are. And it says, no, something bad must have happened. Let's give her endorphins. And so you feel a little buzz. Offers you some pleasure. Like so when you're munching on Thai chilies, like those bird chilies for fun, you might get a little buzzed. Just good to know. You know, having a bad day? Eat some peppers. See what happens. No bad idea? I think you should do it. Anyway, you want to laugh? Here's Guy Fieri. He spices things up. By the way, I just had to say this. This man receives too much hate for doing... I watched this comedian this week. He has done nothing wrong. He's a really good guy. He just wore an unfortunate shirt like a single time, and he has electrocuted hair. That's the only... That's the extent of the superficial criticism against this man. Anyway, I'm going to send you a bit about a comedian on Conan this week. Had a great bit apologizing for Guy, defending Pi, rather. He was a Guy apologist, and I appreciated it. Anyway, he spices things up. So, aside from the physiological reaction that happens when you ingest spicy peppers, one thing to cool you down is to consume a little sugar after you have something spicy. This chemical, capsaicin, which releases this endorphin, is also, when you introduce more pleasure into your mouth, because your mind thinks that sweetness is pleasure. Why? Because you're programmed to think that high-calorie foods are good for you, and if you find them, you should eat them, because you don't know how long you'll last until you find food again. All right? We don't really live in a hunter-gatherer situation, but we still like cake. So, like, it's stuck with us. Even though, like, you can buy more cake, your body still thinks, like, oh, he's, like, hunting squirrels or something, you know? But he found cake. He should eat a lot of it. You know, that's how it works. I'm serious. This is all facts. Anyway, eat some sugar, curb the spice. Try it. Eat some chili peppers and have some honey after. It'll be real good. That's why sriracha has a little sugar in it, so that you can ingest it, so you can eat it without it being real spicy. Also, good to know, if your food is too bitter, add a little salt. It'll help the bitterness. If it's too sweet, introduce some bitterness to it. If it's too salty, add like a citric acid, like something sour, and that'll make it taste less salty. It will not remove sodium from it, though, so that your body will still endure whatever sodium you're pumping into it. Don't be afraid of salt either. In general, you're probably fine. Sorry, that's not medical advice, by the way. That's just Johnny advice. You know, too many undersalted food is vile. Anyway, we can cover up our pain with some pleasure, and sometimes that's okay. Sometimes our pain is too much to bear, and getting a little bit of goodness is okay. Getting a little bit of sweetness is fine. But finding that sweetness beyond the coping mechanism helps you when you're actually in despair. Lent is a little practice ground for when suffering really hits you, and it will. And in our context, we have a limited scope for suffering. There are people who endure much worse. A Lenten fast is about taking away some of those mechanisms and learning how to embrace our suffering, because it is inevitable. This sum of our limits, intentionally experienced suffering, gives us a chance to use it well, maybe even displaying the mighty works of God. I'm not creating a causal relationship. I'm saying this is something that can come of it. What do we do with this limited experience? The Bible writer's audience are all largely very limited in their situation and recipients of suffering. This is certainly true of the early church in Rome, which Paul is writing to in his epistle to the Romans. Poor Christians who really have an idea of what it means to suffer. The suffering serves as an opportunity for deepening. Just like many of our contexts provide an opportunity to get closer to God. Will someone read these five verses, please, out loud?
Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. And we boast in the hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, character, character, and character hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us.
Paul is making the most of suffering here by saying that there is a process that we undergo when we persevere through suffering. One of the only things I can guarantee you is that you will suffer. And as a Christian, you're especially in tune to suffering, to your own and to others, because God has softened your heart. And you know other people who may not even profess faith, but have a soft heart. I work on softening my heart. When the 17 people were killed in Parkland last week, I had a moment where I had an almost reaction to try to numb myself to the pain. And I'm a sensitive person, so I softened. It was Ash Wednesday that it happened, so we had a thing here tonight, and then the next day I saw this image that kind of broke my heart. This woman with ashes crying at the scene. And it's tempting to just numb yourself to it, because it happens so frequently, all the time. There's a lot of pain in the world that we see. But I was happy that my heart was soft enough to just feel the sorrow of the endless and senseless cycle of violence. I feel it. And I think that's part of Jesus working for me, and I want to keep feeling it until something changes. And I don't just mean until, like, you can't buy an AR-15, although that would be nice. I mean until Jesus comes again. You know, both and, right? I can hold out hope for something greater. I can hope that boys turn into adults and stop acting that way. I can also hope that I can't carry a firearm that shoots that strongly, that quickly, for real, for no reason, for no good reason, as far as I'm concerned. So, levels, right? But I can really hold out because I know ultimate hope is coming. Paul is arguing that the suffering in this world leads to hope, leads to love. Our identity with Jesus allows us to die with him and then rise with him. We suffer like Christ did, but we rise like Christ did. He keeps going. I'll read this one. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. Earlier in the chapter, Paul says creation is groaning. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into freedom and the glory of the children of God. There is an inherited limitedness in the world, even in the creation. The finiteness of resources make that clear. Creation groans. We all groan because of our limitedness. Our suffering is a result of that. But we can suffer in our limitedness because we know our fullness, our completion will come. Jesus is inaugurating that reality now. This incompleteness, this worldwide sin, which is not to be reduced to your individual actions exclusively. We suffer because of it. But we suffer and we know that God put sin to death. Our suffering puts us in the greater context of suffering with the whole world and all of creation. We suffer to relate to Jesus, but we also suffer, and when we suffer, we can relate to other oppressed people and to the world. Our advantage, one advantage of this theology, is that it helps put context in our suffering and help us relate to the endless suffering in the world. We aren't immune, but we have hope that it will end. We persevere, develop hope in the present, and know that glory is coming. Our suffering motivates us to help people join us in reconciliation with God. Goodness is coming, and God will bring all suffering into good. But that's not the end of the story. We will continue to suffer on earth, and God will bring that suffering, that vacancy, that void, He'll fill it with glory. There's something wrong. Something is not all right. And Jesus, in His death and resurrection, works to change that. God does not wish people harm. God promises conquest over our suffering as we suffer with Christ, and it awaits us. And Jesus Himself asks the same question. Nothing in all creation, even the most devastating suffering, will separate us from God. If you read the rest of Romans 8, you'll see a very artful ending, where Paul says neither height nor depth nor angel nor demons. Nothing in all of creation can separate us from the love of God. Our present suffering ensures our glorification. We learn that God loves us even through it. So the advantage of this theology is that it contextualizes our suffering and helps us to relate to Jesus and the earth's suffering. We're conformed to the image of God's Son, and we're resurrected with Jesus. What can be dangerous, though, is that you might think Jesus brings about suffering on purpose in order to for us to appreciate the coming glory. Not so. It may lead us to assume suffering is just a condition of life, and we may not want to alleviate it because ultimate suffering is coming, and if we alleviate it, maybe someone won't want to enter into paradise. It may cause us to think of our suffering as connected to holiness, which sometimes you see. Thereby, increasing suffering means being holier on ourselves and on others, and so we intentionally make strange decisions that increase our suffering because we think it makes us closer to God. Again, another risk. And it may numb us to the pain of others. Sometimes you see this. People are suffering and someone will say, well, you know, Jesus is coming, or something like that. So God will work it out. No, I want to alleviate suffering now. You know, and that's a good thing to do. I don't want to avoid it. I want to alleviate it. Can you appreciate that little distinction? I want to end it. I don't want to just cover it up with sugar. Suffering is inevitability. We do not need to collect more. You may have endured enough today. The world is full of sin and full of trouble, but God has conquered that trouble. Jesus has conquered the world which troubles Him. Glory comes. And as we suffer, we find comfort in that coming glory. We don't collect more suffering as a way of amplifying that glory. We will suffer more than enough. So we intentionally suffer to identify with Jesus and with others who are suffering. This does not answer the question of suffering very well, but it allows us to use our suffering for good and to find comfort when we do. There's nothing we can do. When we suffer, we can't just get rid of it. So the question we have to answer is, how can we use what we have? What will we do with it? And I think there are a lot of things that we can do, namely, empathize with Jesus in suffering, but also feel other people's pain. If we numb ourselves too much, if you are not troubled by the world's pain, if you insist on transcending it, when you think that's a great mark on your character to be stoic amid people's suffering. That's why Stoicism, by the way, is getting popular again. This ancient Greek philosophy somehow gaining popularity. If your main goal is to transcend your emotion, I don't think you'll get closer to Jesus, the suffering servant, the chief sufferer. The reality of the world is it's full of pain and full of sorrow, often inexplicable. Like the other day, the Syrian government killed hundreds of its civilians. leading to a ceasefire, finally. By the way, remember Syria? The news media only works sporadically. So you only hear about certain things sometimes, but these things are, the civil war in Syria, hotbed of suffering in the whole world, essentially, one of the worst. Hundreds of civilians died the other day. The world is full of suffering and it's full of pain. We can avoid it pretty effectively. I can't explain it, but it's there, and I want to be part of alleviating it. But the first step for helping those who are suffering is feeling it, empathizing with it. That's what Lent's about, learning how to suffer, positioning yourself to endure suffering. That's exactly what God did in Jesus. Jesus came to earth to suffer with us so that God could show us. Yeah, I know. I see you. I feel it. Position yourself to endure suffering. Eat a chili pepper without sugar. That's a pretty easy one. Get in touch with your pain. Skip the after work drink. Avoid chocolate for a day. Don't grab a handful of Skittles when you're at home and shove it. That's what I do. I love Skittles. Get rid of the little pleasure piece that numbs you and feel a little extra. Some of you are runners. Run an extra mile. Feel a little bit more burn. Doesn't it hurt by the end? This is my recollection. Maybe for me, start some cardio, you know? So that parts of your body don't hurt inexplicably, you know? Deepen how you relate to the suffering servant. Empathize with Jesus and let Jesus empathize with you. And then move towards empathizing with others. That's the idea. Take a little bit. Open your heart towards compassion and towards justice. But start with a little bit of extra suffering. Something you can control to show you, hey, I can actually live my life here. I can move forward despite the inevitability of pain. And take heart, Jesus is with you. At the end of his life, he's about to endure the worst suffering imaginable. And this is really some high-level pain. And, you know, possibly some existential crisis that he suffers when he seems to not be connected to God like he used to be. There's some mysterious things happening there. And he tells his disciples, this is from the NIV, "In this world you will have trouble." There's a lot of ways that this is translated, but I like this one. "But take heart, I have overcome the world." It's a present reality, and it's a coming one too.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.